I'd like to start by acknowledging
the traditional custodians of this land
and pay my respects to their elders
past, present,
and to acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded.
Always was, always will be, Aboriginal land. Hi, welcome to the Colour Cycle podcast. I'm Lena Nahlus, coming to you from the land of the Barramadigal of the Darug Nation, with an interview series documenting the stories of pace-setting artists from culturally diverse backgrounds. Award-winning and one of Australia's leading contemporary artists, Khaled Sibsabi, creates work focused on social justice that aims to challenge the viewer about the media spectacle. He began working as an artist in the mid-80s and credits hip-hop with inspiring him to create music and sound that spoke to alienation and the experience of young people in Western Sydney. His practice has taken him to places of marginalisation, like prisons and detention centres, and back home to Lebanon in search of cultural and spiritual connection. In this conversation, multidisciplinary Perth-born artist and winner of the Blake Prize for Justice in 2011, Abdul Abdullah, begins with a question to Sibsabi about the impact of 9/11 on him as a Muslim.
You know, even till today, not only us, not only me and you, but the whole community, the whole world is grappling with these questions, grappling with these feelings. There's injustices that are caused throughout the world in the history. Doesn't matter what faith, what time, what culture, what ethnicity. You know, human beings have always found ways to hurt others for either being too different or not being the same and so on and so on. And history keeps repeating itself, and the circle of violence just keeps growing and growing and growing. It's not that I'm avoiding your question. I'm actually addressing your question. I think even till today, we toil and we struggle. You know, we try to work through this question in terms of what it means to be a Muslim living in Australia. You know, I went back to Lebanon in 2002. After September 11, 2001, things changed, the world changed. I had questions to ask of myself, so I went back to Lebanon and the surrounding region. I travelled for several years asking these questions and looking and so on. And of course, you know, I felt like I didn't belong here in Australia, with certain ideologies that are still alive and kicking today, and they have the right to be, just like I have the right to be as well. I learned from that experience, and I think our practice is informed by our experiences, and it shapes what we do and the reason for how we do what we do. That is just another lesson for us, to be able to fuel and drive our practice, you know, in a really deep way with the best intention for all. So how do I feel about it personally? I think there's a lot of injustices that need to be addressed, and not just from a Muslim perspective, and to be clear, but also from, you know, living on this land and the traditional owners of this land. Right? So, and I'm an Australian, you're an Australian, okay? And we are part of the conversation, we are part of the discussion, we are part of the problem, but we are also part of the solution. These are all things that manifest themselves in our work, yours and mine, and everyone who wants to contribute with the best intention to this discourse.
That leads me to the experience, like the beginnings of making art, making visual art. So like before I studied art, I studied journalism. I wanted to be the next John Pilger. I'd grown up like so angry, and it was only just beginning or just learning how to articulate why. But when I went to art school, I found these particular explorations were maybe like undermined or discouraged by my lecturers, especially in undergrad, not in postgrad. And this was just after Cronulla in 2005, but it didn't seem that many people, in my experience, were interested, and it was years before I pursued it again. And art school for me was very adversarial. It was like a gauntlet as the only student at the time with a name like mine, what was your experience at art school when you were there, when you first started?
So I'm not a trained artist, okay? So I went through as, I did land surveying, so I'm a qualified land surveyor or land technician. So that's what I studied. We had a recession in the 90s, so I couldn't get a job. So I had to find other ways to sustain myself. And the only way to do that was either do graveyard shift working the breweries or working the abattoirs, the shit jobs that nobody wants to do. Or I found spaces in community development because they were the thriving job sectors at the time of the recession, the welfare sector, basically. So I got in as a youth worker, and from there I was able to work as a youth worker. I was essentially a youth myself. But then I introduced hip-hop as a form of activism and tool and awareness, dealing with issues like racism. Honestly, some of the young people, majority, not some, that didn't know what the word racism meant. And then you would sit there and explain what racism is, and they would go, ha, and I am not bullshitting you. They'd go, ha, that's what I feel. Now I know what I feel. I was the first so-called NES, non-English speaking background street worker that used to work the courts in Lidcombe, and I would turn up and I would give court support, you know, and then I found someone in legal aid that was sympathetic and they would come along and help, right? Because these young people, right, of different cultures, islanders, Arabs, Aboriginal young people would go and they would get themselves more in trouble by speaking, not knowing their rights, and they would be too afraid to tell their parents because they'd get a hiding, right? And by the time it's too late, you bring the parents in, and so on, Abdullah. So these are all important. So for me, when I first enrolled in art was actually in 1999. I decided to do my MA. So I enrolled in COFA at the time, which is the University of New South Wales, College of Fine Arts. And that came about because I used to do the sound, because I used to do sound, right? Yeah. So do your weird hip hop.
Yeah.
But it was like also suited very well to experimental art sound. And to answer your question specifically, that was the first time I was in an art school environment. And I found that very intimidating. Some of the teachers had an understanding of where I was coming from, you know, artistically and philosophically as well. And that was a good thing, but a lot of teachers didn't. The majority of teachers didn't. I would argue with teachers, and one teacher said to me, look, just don't come back, you know, just don't come back. And I felt like this teacher is coming at me in a real sort of highbrow, you know, and that's what really annoyed me. But there was that position of power and taking advantage of that power and asserting themselves in that. And the other thing is the students. I just couldn't handle the students. They were from a totally different class, totally different way of thinking, totally different, you know, construct to what I was used to, right, what I grew up with. And partly, well, maybe it was my fault. Maybe no, it wasn't. But I felt like I was, you know, isolated and targeted, even in 1999. So I decided not to, I put it on hold, my MA, and I took some time off. And that was the time of the birth of my first son, Walid, because he was born in 99. So I took some time off, and it wasn't until 2003, I think, I went back and I enrolled. So I went back to Lebanon in 2002, did about a year, came back, enrolled, and then went back again, and back and forth, and I continued. And I went, so I got all high distinctions. So for someone that didn't belong, but you know what made me enroll back, to come back? It wasn't that I had a point to prove, and it wasn't that. It was my experience abroad. So when I went to Lebanon and to Syria, I could understand the importance of education. And what I mean by that is the privilege of it and the importance of what it could do for you to achieve what you need to achieve, you know, to be taken seriously as such.
The first time I came across your work in the flesh was when you won the Blake Prize in 2011 with your work, I'm going to pronounce it poorly here, but Naqshbandi Green Acre Engagement. I believe you were the first Muslim to win, and our friend Khadim Ali won the Highly Commended. I was living in Perth at the time, and I'd won the Blake Prize for Human Justice, but I believe you were in residency in Lebanon at the time, so for better or worse, I got all the press. But and a politician in Sydney wrote that I was wanting to convert young Australians and that I worshipped a moon god. It all got a little bit nuts, and I think it pissed a lot of people off that so many Muslims were involved in a religion and spirituality prize. Can you please tell me a little bit more about that winning work that I've since seen at the MCA and about the experience of winning a prize like that?
Yeah, sure, Abdullah. The work is called Naqshbandi, Green Acre Engagement. Naqshbandi is one of the paths in tasawwuf, known in English Sufism, but it's actually tasawwuf. We don't say Sufism. Sufism is a Western construct. Naqshbandi is one of the paths, one of the great paths of learning in tasawwuf. And there's Rifai and Qadri and Jailani and so on, all these other paths. Scholarships in tasawwuf. For me, the idea of tasawwuf, it's really important. And in 2002, when I went back, I reconnected with my lineage and my learning with tasawwuf. Lineage in terms of family, right? So it's always been in our family. I remember memories of it when I was growing up, but we were sort of, because due to civil war for years and you're a young kid, so you know, you remember the rhythms and the ceremonies, but they're like dreams, you know. But in 2003 I reconnected, and that was a moment of real enlightenment for me, real joy, in the sense that I could see that, you know, things were starting subconsciously, that I had memories that they were manifesting in right in front of me physically, and I could find a meaning in them, right? So they were being reconstructed in a sense, right? And one thing led to another and another, and then it all involved travel and discussions and learning and travel and staying in places for long periods of time, you know, weeks on end to learn with teachers and, you know, sit in isolation and you know, and all these sort of things that you only read about. That period when I did the Naqshbandi Green Acre Engagement, it was part of Edge of Elsewhere. So it was 3 years, three works, right? I decided to do three works. First work was called 99. 99 was a really simple work. It was 99 channel video with 99 monitors using the old tube TVs. And it was like a pathway that led into the gallery. So you were pretty much, the idea of pathways already being created physically around you. Each television had a video of a dervish spinning one revolution behind the Darwish spinning. It had images of hate. So the idea was 99, we all know the significance of 99 because it refers to the 99 most beautiful names of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and the attributes. But the idea for me, it was playing on the idea of a revolution, the idea of whether it's a physical revolution or whether it's a philosophical revolution. The idea of the coup of being a revolution for change from the outer or the inner of revolution, because although the Sufi are the Darwish spins, you know, it's inwards, it's not the outer, and the outer is the hate, and the inner, the heart, is the purity. So that's what that was symbolizing in the sense. The second year I did Naqshbandi Greenacre engagement, so I wanted to really subvert the image, right? So I started to look at if there was any Tasawwuf communities in Australia, and I ended up finding three or four at the time. You know, one was in Tasmania, one was in Broken Hill, I think. And then it just happened, there was two in Sydney. And the one that responded to me first was in Greenacre. And I went, oh, great. You know, and they said, yeah, you know, you're welcome, come on this. And I was already aware of zikr, you know, zikr, the ceremonies. So I already attended a few of those in Lebanon and abroad. So I already had personal connection with them already. So that's all good. And then they said, oh, yeah, we meet in the Scouts Hall at Greenacre every Saturday. You know, we get together, a few families and this. I said, oh, do you mind if I come? No, no, you're most welcome, come. So I went. I didn't have the intention to do a work. For me, the intention was just to observe and get to know them. I didn't go there to make a work. I didn't want to make a work for the second year. I wanted to make a work for the third year. So from 1 week to another, to another, to another, a month passed, 2 months passed, I got to know the families really well. They're beautiful families. And they came to the openings, and after the exhibition for several years, I kept contact with them for a few years afterwards. But, you know, they were just a couple of families, maybe four different families, and they would get together in this Scouts Hall. And at the time, they couldn't access the mosque because Tasawwuf was frowned on in those days, and even till today. Some people say that it's shirk. Some people say that it's indulgence. And in some ideas of for some Muslims, they just think that Tasawwuf has no place. These are contemporary ideas, and they're very complex ideas, and I don't want to even go into those. For me, what was really striking about that environment, that space, is I walked into a Scouts Hall, Abdullah, and this is where they met. And they had, the first thing that struck me is those flags. They're actually Scout flags. So if you look in the work, they're actually Scout flags. So red, green, and yellow. To me, red, green, and yellow. Okay, green, Islamic, red, Islamic of the faith, yellow, another Hezbollah, you know. So it's already like I can make these associations from color, right? And they would sit there and do their zikr. And, you know, they're just reciting and doing their zikr, and their children are running up and down, and sometimes sleeping, sometimes shouting, sometimes eating. And I thought, man, this is so beautiful, because spirituality in the everyday is here. It's everywhere. It's not exclusive. It's not, you know, bound by rules. It's not really. It's the heart. It's the essence of, that's the purity of spirituality and belief and faith. You know, you can pray 24/7, but if your heart is not in true belief of something, then it's useless. And that's what that work represented to me in that context. It's a long work. It's like it goes for an hour or something, right? But it's in real time. Three cameras, three perspectives, on three monitors, those flags, you're subverting the image. The quality of the video is shot on SD video, right? Very domestic. I made the work in 2010 or something, Abdullah, you know. And so it's not HD, it's not 4K, it's like domestic, everyday. This is it, you know, play it, come in, sit down, and experience, be part of it. The way I presented the work was on three TVs, the three different camera angles. And on it, there was a rug for to invite people to sit down. And there was the book, the Zikr book, that they use to read. And what's also caught my eye in the book is, although it's in Arabic for those people that read in Arabic, there's not a translation, but what would they call it? It's appropriating the Arabic into English. So you're reading it in English to sound like Arabic. So I thought that was crazy. But anyway, man, I think the whole idea is the idea of the fear of the image, using the big scary monster to scare you about terrorism when it's actually just families and wanting to be together, who they themselves, from their own community, Muslim community, have also been isolated and marginalized as well. So it's quite a complex thing, man. It's not black and white. When I got the call from the Reverend and he called me, it was like early morning when he called me. I go, oh, that's a funny number. Oh, I better answer it. So I answered it. And I was in Beirut at the time. It was around 2011, so Syria was just starting to get hot, I think. And he said, oh, this is Khaled. Yeah, you've won the Blake Prize. Oh, great, thank you. And then I saw Kadim Ali, Abdullah Abdullah. Wow, this is fantastic. This is awesome. You know, I didn't know you. I didn't know Kadim. You didn't know me. And all of a sudden, it's like drought, drought, drought. And all of a sudden, this, you know, starts to pour. Yeah. And it was the best thing for me to see that. And that was awesome. So beyond the happy times, we copped a lot of shit. Yeah. I was really, really upset, Abdullah, because there was a program, you know, and I'm entitled to be upset because, you know, there was something published in the Sydney Morning Herald by a critic, and also the ABC did something as well. And I felt, you know, like, you're doing this, I understand, you know, it is art, and art is subjective, and you're entitled to your opinion, I'm entitled to my opinion, but please, you know, put me down as much as you want, but please do not misrepresent or judge the subject, the community, and their intention, and what they're doing, because you're not there, you're not part of the community. You don't understand what is going on. And that really hurt me because of what they said about the community, that they were sitting in a video being bored, you know, they don't want to be there. And it was like, it was an attack. It was an all-out attack. For what reasons? I don't understand and I don't know. And I don't want to say that I know, but it was an attack. I understand. You don't like my work? Great. Fantastic. But the community, these people, these are families, these are normal people, right? Do not judge them because you don't know who they are or what their circumstances are. So, yeah, this we did cop a lot. We did cop a lot. And a lot of misinformation, Abdullah. You know, a lot of misinformation about your work, about my work, about Kadim's work, and it's still there. I mean, but, you know, we were never part of Western art history. No. And maybe that is the problem. There's no benchmark to gauge it. Maybe we're pioneers, but maybe we're not. I was speaking to someone today, but we were talking about that. Maybe it's always been there. Islamic art has always been there and it's always developed and continued to grow throughout the ages. But for some reason, they've decided to grab one segment of it and call it, this is Islamic art up to the 8th century or the 6th century, and then after that, it doesn't exist. I don't see the logic. What, do these people just disappeared for 600 years and stopped being creative? I don't get it, man. So I don't think we're pioneers. I think it's always been there. It's just that, you know, people that collect and they're responsible for these, you know, ideas of Western art have chosen not to include us in those stories. Maybe.
The first work that I was lucky or I had the privilege of yours to experience with you was the work 70,000 Veils, 100 channel video work made to be viewed through 3D glasses, and I saw it at the museum at RMIT in Melbourne. I don't know if I've ever experienced a work that was as labor intensive as well. Like, it was a fascinating process. Can you tell me about the work, what the title refers to, and what you went through to make it?
Sure, I'll do it very briefly, Abdullah. 70,000 Veils, the idea came from our Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings of Allah be upon him. When he was asked, he said there are 70,000 veils between the individual and the divine, none between the divine and the individual. Why 70,000 veils? What are the veils? Are they physical veils? Are they the veils that, you know, you see, you know, put on someone's head? These are all the things that I was thinking about for years, and I asked my teachers about it, and, you know, what does this mean? You know, it's fascinated me. You know, when you get something, Abdullah, and it just fascinates you and it sticks in your mind. It keeps coming back and back. In Jalaluddin Rumi's writings, he talks about also the 70,000 veils. So he expands on it as well. So all the great scholars, Ghazali, Ibn Arabi, Jalaluddin Rumi, they also mention, they speak about the 70,000 veils. I started to get this idea, and as sort of I had 10 years of travel, Abdullah, very quickly, I had 10 years of travel, and along those travel, as you know, you take pictures, right? So every day, pictures, some extraordinary moments, some mundane, etc., etc. So I took about 10,000 photos in over 10 years, and then I bought those 10,000 photos, and over a period of 4 years, three to four years, I started to post-produce those. So I imported each photo into image, into Photoshop, and then stripped back, you know, 10,000, seven layers from each photo. And then it's like sort of the idea of deconstructing and then reconstructing, but in a sort of a taking a formalist image and then reconstructing that, destroying and then recreating that. And then it becomes this sort of abstract thing. And then I started to ask myself, while I was doing this over and over and over again, it was really tedious and labor intensive. And it led to, you know, having carpal tunnel on both hands and having operations. Very painful, even till now, my hands are not as good as what they used to be. So the idea for me is the 3D axis is a threshold, it's 70,000, there's all this numerology going on, there's all these things. I don't even understand what the work is. It the idea of, you know, 70,000 memories that we take with us, or 70,000 intentions or actions, or is it 70,000 levels of enlightenment? And we talk about, faiths talk about one level of enlightenment, But then to have 70,000 levels of enlightenment, can you even imagine that? Can you even comprehend that? It's like the deeper you go into it, the more you see in that work. And really for me, it's a once-in-a-lifetime work. I could never attempt to do a work like that again, because, yeah, I just couldn't, physically I can't do it anymore. I don't have the means to do it anymore. So, yeah, that's 70,000 veils, bro.
There are a few other artists practicing in Australia who have your international experience, I think. Like, you've been curated into biennales in Yinchuan, Kochi, Marrakesh and Sharjah, as well as in Australia and Adelaide and Sydney. Are there differences in the way audiences engage with your work here and overseas?
Good question, Abdullah. What my opinion is, you know, I'm sure a lot of people would disagree with it, but I feel there's work that is relevant here in Australia, and it's specific to this place and this time, and then there's work that is relevant globally and internationally and universally. Parts of my work belong in that global discussion, because the themes that I'm dealing with are not just Australian. Yes, they're born out of the Australian experience, and I am Australian, and I want to assert that as well and own that, because for a long time I've been dismissed. My practice has been dismissed in Australia as being, well, he's not an Australian artist, we don't look at him. You know, he's a Lebanese artist, or he's a Muslim artist, or, you know, well, whatever way to sort of try to derail your practice. But I was showing internationally long before I was showing in this country. And I think that's really important. And Australia needs to be part of that international discourse. You know, we need to have those global conversations. Yes, we need to have conversations, internal conversations also. But we also need those international and global conversations as well.
That was Khalid Sibsabi speaking with Abdul Abdullah. The music you heard was Dog and Kanon, created and produced by Khalid Sibsabi in 2003. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast. And please check out our other exciting pacesetter interviews on the Colour Cycle podcast with culturally diverse pioneering artists. This interview was recorded by Abdul Abdullah and produced by Najet El Gauli on Gadigal land of the Eora Nation and Cabrigal land of the Darug Nation. I'm Lena Nahlus from Diversity Arts Australia. See you next time.